On my 24th birthday, my mother called me to let me know that Kanga had died. Kanga was 18 years old at the time, and for a cat, it was actually a pretty long run, but still, she was our family pet, and we all took it pretty hard. I was living in Tallahassee, Florida at the time, and I couldn't make it back home for the funeral service, and I was really sorry that I couldn't make it back when my mom called me to tell me how the funeral service went. She had gathered a few of her friends, closest friends, in our backyard, and they had decided to bury Kanga in an area that I like to call the pet cemetery. Kanga had a central plot, but she was nestled among the various fish and hermit crabs and other things that I had destroyed during my youth. And one by one, my mom's friends went around, and they each shared a special memory that they had of Kanga. It was very nice. As they were about to bury her, someone suggested that it would be appropriate maybe to sing Kanga's favorite song. Now, of course, no one had bothered to ask Kanga while she was alive what her favorite song was. So after a few minutes of debate, they eventually settled on a song by Cat Stevens. So cut, if you will, to a suburban backyard in Columbia, Maryland on a cold January day, where if you listen carefully, you could probably hear five middle-aged women weeping uncontrollably and singing at the top of their lungs, "Morning has broken." So, I think in retrospect, looking back on it, Kanga's death did hit me pretty hard at the time, and it was really because she was the closest member of my family who had passed away at that point. And those of you who have pets know that I don't hesitate when I say family member and cat in the same sentence. A few years later, my grandmother Sylvia passed away in her sleep, and a few years after that, my grandfather John had a stroke and passed away. But like Kanga, they were older and had led relatively productive and ostensibly happy lives, and so while we mourned, there wasn't a lot of shock or surprise associated with it. In October of 2002, I got a call from the emergency room at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. The admitting nurse had said that they had found my mother, and that she was found on a subway platform at Metro Center, that she was rambling incoherently, she was unable to walk, and wanted me to get down there as soon as I could. When I got down there, my mom was unconscious, and they had to drill a hole in the side of her head to relieve the swelling that was going on around her brain. The doctors very calmly explained to me that my mom had had a brain aneurysm. And basically, about half of the people who have brain aneurysms, which is when an artery that's carrying blood to your brain bursts, about half of the people who have them die on the spot. A number of them end up dying shortly afterwards, and a lot of the survivors end up having permanent brain damage. And the doctor explained to me they had scheduled my mom for a surgery in the morning where they were going to saw off the top of her skull and clip the offending artery and kind of hope for the best. So I called my brother, who lived in Atlanta. He was up in D.C. within a couple hours, and we spent the night in the waiting room, in the emergency room, trying to get a couple hours sleep in these unbelievably uncomfortable chairs that they have in emergency rooms in hospitals. And as scheduled, my mom went in for her surgery the next day. It was an eight-hour surgery, so I had a lot of time to think. And this was all pretty unfathomable. I mean, my mother was 60 years old. She was in perfect health. She had no medical history at all, and the idea that she was going to die, which was a very, very real possibility, hadn't really occurred to me. And so with all this time on my hands, and kind of being the oldest child and living closest to home, I knew that I would be responsible for the funeral arrangement. So I started to mentally plan her funeral. Now, the closest approximation that I had was Kanga's funeral. That was all that I had to go on. And I knew at once there were a few elements that just weren't going to fly. I really doubted I was going to get permission from the Columbia Association to bury Mom in the backyard. And in the off chance that I did, I had no idea where I was going to find a shoebox quite that big. Some of the other elements, though, I knew would work. I mean, certainly family members, some of my mom's closest friends would be there, and we'd all go around and say nice things about her. And I knew music would be a really integral element of the service as well. My mom loved music. She had this very annoying habit of singing in this exaggerated, over-the-top way that just embarrassed the crap out of me and my brother, although she always had the good sense never to do it in public. And I had a very vivid recollection of my mom singing one of her favorite songs, which is a really popular tune by the Rolling Stones. And so I kind of mentally filed it away just in case I needed it. My mom pulled through the surgery, and she spent the next month at Inova Fairfax Hospital in Virginia in the intensive care unit, basically unconscious. And she had a number of complications while she was there, vasospasms, heart murmurs, and a particularly frightening incident involving massive rectal bleeding. And I know my mother's not here, by the way. She would be horrified that I just said that in front of 500 strangers. But I figure I don't get a chance to say massive rectal bleeding in public. So I thought I would just kind of throw it out there. Just about Thanksgiving time, I got a call from Anita, who was one of my mom's closest friends. She was very excited. She said that my mom had signaled for a pen and some paper. And my mom had basically been in a coma for a month, and this was her first effort to communicate. So we were really excited. And I asked her, you know, what did my mom write? And Anita said that in her very unmistakable but somewhat shaky handwriting, she had written down, "Somebody get me a fucking Diet Coke now." And so it was about that point where we knew mom was going to be okay. So it was still a long road to recovery. She spent a month at Kernan Hospital in Baltimore doing her rehab, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. Then 6 months of full-time home health care, outpatient therapy, I mean, you name it, she had it. And during all that time, I lived in Baltimore, I spent pretty much every day with her just, you know, talking. And, you know, parent-child relationships, all of you have parents, a lot of you have children, there are certain boundaries to the conversations. You know, there are certain things you talk about, there are certain things that you don't. And all of that seemed kind of irrelevant at this point in time in the relationship. And so my mom and I just talked, and we talked about our lives, and we talked about our friends, we talked about our jobs. And my mom confided in me about a lot of the anxieties that she had had about growing old alone and some of the depression she had suffered from. I never knew any of this before. And I confided in my mother about my marriage, which was failing miserably at the time, and a few years later ended up in divorce, and it was the first time I'd ever talked about it with her. And, you know, our relationship had always been good, but it always had been defined by the parent-child bond. And it still was, and it still is, but it was somewhat transcended. And just as her mind and her body were completely rebuilding and rehealing, our relationship changed as well. My mom is doing fine now, a lot better. About 2 weeks ago, she celebrated 5 years since the surgery. We call it her anniversary. And I thought it was, I came up with that, I thought it was pretty clever. Thank you. She took early retirement from work, she takes yoga classes, she takes bridge classes, she's much more involved with her synagogue, and while she has a lot of the anxieties that she had before, and plus a few new ones to boot, she seems to approach them with an, you know, if you will, it sounds kind of trite, but a newfound appreciation for life, a newfound respect and gratitude for what it is that she has. And I know that things weren't always that way. After one particularly grueling day at the hospital doing her rehabilitation, I took my mom back to her room, and she started to cry. And she told me that she wished that she would have died. And that it was too hard for her, and she knew how hard it had been for me and for my brother. And I had no idea how to respond. I mean, what do you say to something like that? And there were so many things I wanted to say, primarily about how proud I was of her, about how far she had come, about what she had accomplished, and about the person that she was. But I couldn't find those words now. I can barely find them now. So instead, the best that I could do is I took her hand, and I leaned in, and I reached back to that Rolling Stones song that I never got to use. And I said, "You know, Mom, you can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you might find you get what you need."
I so heard you. glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a